to Isaiah chapter 15, and my intention will be to take a large chunk of Isaiah now, and this will be possible because the material before us for the next several chapters does not contain any of those classic passages such as we've been running into every couple chapters in the first 14 chapters. You know, in chapters 1 through 14, you don't go very far until you run into some of these fantastic, classic, exciting passages that have something to say about Jesus or the kingdom of God or something that that you can just really spend a lot of time chewing on. But what we have in chapters 13 through 23 are 11 chapters which are called the burdens of the nations, and we took two of those chapters in our last session, which were chapters 13 and 14. And we found that they even had one of those classic passages about Lucifer, and we discussed that at some length. However, the remaining portion of this section, chapters 15 now through 23, doesn't have any passages of that stature, of the stature of some of these great passages in chapter 2 and chapter 5 and chapter 6 and chapter 7 and chapter 9 and chapter 11 and chapter 14. I mean, you just every few chapters up, we've been running into things that are really weighty. Well, not that these chapters are not weighty. I have no doubt that they were certainly weighty at the time they were ushered, and that's why they were, of course, called burdens, because they are weighty. They are prophecies of judgment upon Gentile nations. The problem with us as modern readers trying to get out of them what was intended originally is that a lot of the nations that are mentioned are nations that don't exist anymore, or certainly whose status has changed remarkably since the prophecies were uttered. I dare say that the vast majority of the things predicted that we're about to read must be already fulfilled, though in the absence of a thorough knowledge of the history of Moab or the history of Assyria, we don't know exactly in what way these were fulfilled. We can be sure that they were fulfilled. Certainly the Jews would not have retained these chapters and considered Isaiah a true prophet if these words didn't come true. So we must assume that those who lived to see the fall of these nations recognized that they fell exactly in the way that was predicted, or that the judgments came upon them as they were described. So we might experience at some point a little frustration that we don't know more about how the particular wording of these prophecies describe specific judgments that came on some of these nations, but we will find some very interesting statements. Some of them perhaps have abiding value to us in all generations, and there are definitely some passages that are very interesting to study. And so we'll try to take the remainder of the burdens of the nations in this session, though I can't guarantee we shall. That would take us up through chapter 23. Some of these chapters are very short, and obviously some of them we won't have very much we can say about them, because the language is poetic to the degree that in some cases you don't really know how the prophecy was intended until it's fulfilled. You may have noticed that with some prophecies, that the poetic language renders it almost impossible to be sure what it is it's predicting until you see the fulfillment, and then you say, oh, so that's what that meant. And since we don't know exactly how they were fulfilled in every case here, there are some cases where we just don't know what the poetic language refers to, but it's very clear that these are judgments that come on these nations. Now, I think what I will do, there will be times when I will skip over paragraphs and portions that about which there's nothing that can be said, and opt for commenting on verses that do have some interesting application to us. We'll start at chapter 15, the burden of Moab. Because in the night Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night Kir of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. He has gone up to Bajib and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo, over Medeba. On all their heads shall be baldness and every beard cut off. Now these obviously are the names of Moabite cities. I believe that the destruction of Moab here predicted is probably that which was executed by Assyria against Moab. If not, then certainly by the time Nebuchadnezzar came on the scene, the king of Babylon, then these then the judgments would certainly have fallen, because both Assyria and Babylon did great damage to all the little nations in the Middle East, including Moab. So whether the actual destruction and judgment is that of Assyria or Babylon would be hard, at least with my present knowledge, to ascertain. But when it says that people in these cities will go up to the high places to weep, and it says all their heads shall be bald and every beard cut off, this is a reference to mourning rituals of people of the East, to shave their heads, to shave their beards, to go up and weep. This is talking about death. You know, there's rampant death. These cities are wiped out by war, and therefore everyone is going to be mourning. In the streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. Again, what is done when you're mourning the dead. On the tops of their houses and in the streets, everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. And Heshbon shall cry, and Elealeh, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce that. Their voice shall be heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out, his life shall be grievous unto him. My heart shall cry out for Moab, his fugitives shall flee unto Zoar, an heifer of 3 years old, for by the mounting up of Luhith with weeping shall they go up, shall they go it up. For in the way of Horonaim they shall raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate, for the hay is withered away, and the grass faileth. There is no green thing. Therefore the abundance they have gotten, and that which they have laid up, shall they carry away to the brook of the willows. For the cry is gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof unto Eglaim, and the howling thereof unto Beerilim. For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood, for I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon them that escapeth of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land. Now this prophecy against Moab continues in the next chapter, and through chapter 16. It says, send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah, to the wilderness, unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast, bewray not him that wandereth. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceaseth, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. We have heard of the pride of Moab, he is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. Therefore shall Moab howl for Moab. Everyone shall howl, for the foundations of Kir-Hazeseth, or something like that, Kir-Har-Eseth, shall ye mourn. Surely they are stricken, for the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah. The lords of the heathen have broken down the principal plants thereof. They are come even to Jazer. They wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out, they are gone over the sea. Therefore I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting of for thy summer fruits, and for the harvest is fallen, and gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field, and in the vineyards they shall be no singing. Neither shall there be shouting. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage shouting to cease. Wherefore, my bowels shall sound like an harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kir-Haresh. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. This is the word that the Lord hath spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord hath spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of an hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be condemned. And all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. Now let me just share a few things out of this. it's just classic language of mourning, how that everyone will be mourning, there will be no more rejoicing, there will be no more reaping the fruit of the vine, which would be always a time of rejoicing when they reap the grapes, and then they go press out the first wine, and they go have a big celebration and get drunk. All signs of joy will be taken away. It says in verse 10, and the gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field, and in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting, and so forth. Now, in the midst of all of this, there's a few points worth noting. One of them is that Moab, of course, were the people who were descended from Lot by one of his two daughters. Lot, when he fled from Sodom, at the warning of God, remember, he left with two daughters and a wife. And his wife looked back when fire and brimstone was falling from heaven upon Sodom, and she was turned to a pillar of salt. So Lot and his two daughters went up into the mountains. First they went to Zoar, because they asked for permission to do that. Zoar was originally one of the little cities of the plain that was supposed to be wiped out along with Sodom and Gomorrah. But God, the angel, told Lot, you flee to the mountains. And Lot said, I can't make it to the mountains. Some evil may overtake me. So let me go to Zoar. And so the angel gave him that option and spared Zoar. But then he was afraid to dwell in Zoar, and he went on up into the mountains. And in a cave there with his two daughters, he lived out the remainder of his days. One of the last things that's recorded about Lot in Genesis chapter 19 is that his two daughters got him drunk and slept with him, and each of them became pregnant, and one of them produced a child that gave rise to the Ammonites, and the other produced a child that gave rise to the Moabites. So Moab is one of these tribes that came out of Lot. And there are some things in the prophecy where the prophet is sort of echoing this story that we've just told about Lot and his daughters fleeing. For instance, in chapter 15 and verse 5, he says, my heart shall cry out for thee, Moab, as fugitives shall flee unto Zoar. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar. Now, whether this is a literal true thing, that the Moabites, when they were under attack from the Assyrians or the Babylonians, fled to Zoar, I can't say, because I don't have the historical knowledge. But whether it's literal or not, it certainly has symbolic value, because Moab's ancestor, Lot, and his daughters, who eventually produced Moab, did flee to Zoar from a destroyed, doomed city, Sodom. And as judgment was coming on Sodom, Lot and his family fled as fugitives to Zoar. And in saying that the fugitives of Moab will flee to Zoar, whether or not this means literally they'll flee to that city or not, it is essentially comparing the destruction of Moab with the destruction of Sodom. And any who escape this destruction will flee just like Lot and his daughters did, unto Zoar. Zoar might simply be a symbol of where Lot and his daughters fled when Sodom was destroyed, and basically the fugitives will have to flee from a similar destruction of their own land in Moab. There's also a reference to it in verse 2 of the next chapter, chapter 16 and verse 2. It says, for it shall be that as the wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be. It's like Lot and his family were like birds cast out of the nest. Their nest and their home was in Sodom, but they were left homeless, wandering, looking for a place to live. That was basically the background of Moab's origins. And so it'll be that way again, that the Moabites, because of this destruction, will be left without a home. They'll be wanderers, like a bird that's cast out of its nest. But then there's some interesting verses, not entirely easy to interpret, in verses 4 and 5. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end. The spoiler ceaseth. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. And in mercy shall the throne be established. And he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. There does seem to be, in verse 5, an apparent messianic reference talking about sitting on the throne in the tabernacle of David. We know from chapter 9 and verse 7 that the Messiah will sit on the throne of his father David. But how this relates to Moab is not clear in the passage. It does say, let my outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. What I believe this is referring to is that when the Israelites were to be spoiled by the Assyrians, those who would flee from that some of them would flee to Moab seeking refuge. And the Moabites were being encouraged by the prophet to take them in, basically to indebt God to them somehow by doing something favorable toward God's people, because God will eventually have a ruler who rules mercifully and is sitting on David's throne. Now, this is probably a reference to Jesus, and saying basically the Moabites, who were not God's people, should take the side of God's people, as it were. When they're fleeing from their enemies, the Moabites should take them in and should show hospitality to them. And as they are running from the spoiler, because he says in the middle of verse 4, because the spoiler and the extortioner will someday cease, but there will be a throne that doesn't cease, and that'll be the Messianic kingdom. Now, this probably means this, that as people like the Assyrians and the Babylonians smite God's people and cause many of them to flee as refugees to surrounding territories, including to the land of Moab, Moab should receive them graciously and show hospitality to them, and not fear retaliation from those greater powers like Assyria and Babylon, because those oppressors will cease someday. And it's better to have God on your side. It's better to not fear those who can kill the body and do no more, but to fear God. And so some people, of course, would not take in the refugees when they were fleeing from Babylon or Assyria, big nations like that, because that would, of course, make them the target for those nations too. And he's basically saying those oppressors are not forever. The spoiler, the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceases, meaning there's these ones who are driving God's people out are only temporary rulers themselves, and you need not fear them ultimately, but you need to fear God, who will set up an eternal throne, actually a merciful throne that will be established forever. And he, in verse 5, he shall sit upon it. It doesn't have an antecedent. You'd expect the pronoun he to have a particular person in an earlier verse that was mentioned, but it doesn't. Apparently it means simply he that sits on the throne. The throne was mentioned before that. He shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David. So, apart from that reference, there's not a whole lot to really dig into out of this particular burden on Moab. It does say in verse 12 that it shall come to pass when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. That is, Moab will come into their own gods, into their temple, seeking help from their gods, but their gods won't be able to save them when they're under attack. And then in verse 4, he actually sets a date, which would seem to make Assyria the oppressor in this particular case, because he says, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, the glory of Moab shall be contemned with all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. So if it was to take place within 3 years, if that's literal, then that would have to be Assyria's time, because Isaiah lived during the time when Assyria was powerful, not when Babylon was powerful, though he did predict some things about Babylon in some of his prophecies. So he does set a time. It's interesting, because you remember that in the earlier prophecy in chapter 8, that it was said about Isaiah's son, Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz, that before he could say, my father, my mother, before he could discern between good and evil, the two kings of Assyria and Israel, of Syria and Israel, would be destroyed by Assyria. And that would be, you know, in the general time it takes a child to learn to talk, which would be a couple of years. Here, a similar period of time, 3 years in this case, is set as the length of time before the prophecy is fulfilled. It's really kind of neat, in a sense, when a prophet actually tells the time frame for the fulfillment of his prophecy. Because a lot of times a prophecy will be given that isn't fulfilled for hundreds of years, and the people of his own day would never live to see if it was fulfilled. But when a prophet can say that within 3 years this is going to happen, or within 2 years, or until, before this baby is weaned, or something like that, you know, that really gives a short-term fulfillment that the people can see in their own time, and it really confirms that the prophet's not just speaking with, you know, off the top of his head. He's really risking something. I mean, if I told you here, the Lord has shown me that in 200 years such and such is going to happen, I really take no risk in saying that, because none of us are going to be around to see if that really happens or not. But if I say 3 weeks from now such and such is going to happen, then I'm really sticking my neck out, and I really have to know I'm hearing from God. When a prophet does that, it shows that he's not just talking through his hat. The next two chapters are prophecies about Damascus, the burden of Damascus. Now, Damascus was the capital of Syria. Now, we've already seen some prophecies against Syria in the earlier chapters because it was confederate with Israel coming against Jerusalem. And we already were told that within the time that Isaiah's son was old enough to speak, basically to learn his first words, that this kingdom would be kind of defeated by the Assyrians. Now, there's more on it. There's not a whole lot I want to make comments about on it, but we'll go ahead and read it, and if I see anything that I need to comment on, I read it earlier today, and there weren't a whole lot of things that needed comment or that I could elucidate with comments. The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So the cities will be so desolate that there will be nothing but pastures of grass there, where there was once a metropolis. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria, and they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. Now this is a statement of judgment, that his glory and his fatness would speak of his prosperity, really. I mean, if a person was fat, they were considered to be under the blessing of God. They were prospering. And it says, in that day their fatness and their glory will be made thin or lean. The blessing would no longer be evident upon them. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathereth corn and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. Now, what it's saying here is there will be a remnant left. And that's what he said also about Moab in the last chapter, in the last verse. He said, the remnant shall be small and feeble. Notice how frequently Isaiah's messages have something to do with a remnant, even mostly the remnant of Israel. But in this case, even when he prophesies against the heathen nations, he stresses that, in some cases at least here, he stresses that there will be a remnant that is left after the judgment, a very small and feeble remnant. In this case, he compares the judgment upon Damascus as when a person's basically harvesting his crop of wheat or berries or whatever, and he just takes it by the armloads and you know, carries it out, but there's some gleaning behind. In the case of, in verse 6, he's comparing it to a vineyard, like gleaning grapes. And of course, that's what's left after the harvesters have gone through and plucked all the big clusters of grapes that they can see. They would always leave, by the law, of at least Israel they would. I don't know whether all the other societies around did similar things, but they'd leave the gleaning, that is what the reapers didn't think was plump enough to bother with, or what they couldn't carry because their basket was already full, so they left it behind. They'd leave those for the poor. But it would ordinarily be a few here or there, you know, a few berries at the top of the uppermost bough that couldn't be reached very easily, four or five out in the outermost fruitful branches. No, it's just a few here and a few there. And that's basically saying that after the great harvest of judgment comes on Damascus, the remnant of the people that will be left will be like a few berries here and there after the harvest has passed. They're the gleaning afterwards. Verse 7, and at that day shall a man look to his Maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. In that day shall his strong cities be a forsaken bough, and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation. Because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength, therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants, and shalt set it with strange slips. In that day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish, but the harvest shall be as a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of the nations, that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing, some translations say tumbleweed, before the whirlwind. And behold, at eventide trouble, and before the morning he is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. Now, this last statement in verse 14 speaks of the rapidness of the judgment. At eventide, just as the sun's going down, they begin to sense trouble. And before morning, they're gone. It's like in the time just before, between the evening of sundown and sunrise the next morning, the whole is finished. He is not. He doesn't exist anymore by morning, even though he just begins to sense trouble in the evening before. When it strikes sudden. Chapter 18 continues against Damascus. It's very short, seven verses. Woe to the land shadowing the wings with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sendeth ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes, upon the waters, saying, Go ye swift messengers to a nation scattered and peeled, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled. All ye inhabitants of the world, and dwellers on the earth, see ye, when he lifteth up an ensign on the mountains, and when he bloweth a trumpet, hear ye. For so the Lord saith unto me, I will take my rest, and I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon herbs, and like a cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, and the sour grape is ripening in the flower, he shall both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks, and take away and cut down the branches. They shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountains, and to the beasts of the earth, and the fowls shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. In that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, and from a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden underfoot, whose land the rivers have spoiled, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion. Obviously some very difficult parts to interpret there, but it is throughout it's talking in terms of branches being cut off, same kind of imagery that we've seen elsewhere in the scriptures very frequently. A nation is compared to a tree, and judgment of it is the cutting down or the chopping off of the branches of the tree. That kind of imagery is what's being used, but nothing, not much I can say about this. It does say in verse 7, At that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled. This seems to refer to the fact that after the purging of judgment takes place, there will be some who turn to God. It does seem to say that also, of course, in chapter 17 and verse 7. In that day shall a man look to his Maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. He shall not look to his altars or to his idols or images. Suggests that there will be some who take warning and learn their lesson from this judgment. And the remnant that is left, some of them will turn to God. And so he will, in a sense, receive something out of this. It won't just be an unfruitful thing, but the judgment will produce a present for the Lord of a people who were scattered and peeled. That is, a people who have been who have suffered a great deal, but through their suffering have turned to him and have become his out of it. Now we have in chapters 19 and 20 a prophecy against Egypt. Now, once you get to chapter 20, it's not just Egypt, but Egypt and Ethiopia. But in chapter 19, it's Egypt, principally. And it does have some interesting features in it. The burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother, and everyone against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof. And they shall seek to the idols, and to the charmers, and to them that have familiar spirits, and to wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over to the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts. I have no doubt this is a reference to Nebuchadnezzar. So it looks considerably beyond the present time of Isaiah to the time of Nebuchadnezzar. I don't believe the Egyptians ever came under the rulership of the Assyrians, if I'm correctly informed, but they were defeated by Nebuchadnezzar. I think throughout the whole time of the Assyrian power, Egypt always was a rival power of almost equal stature. That Assyria and Egypt, I think, were kind of equals, with Assyria having a bit of an edge over Egypt. But I remember when Jerusalem was besieged by Assyria, they sent envoys to Egypt hoping to get assistance from Egypt, which Egypt never responded to. But Egypt was the other great power besides Assyria. But later on, Egypt was no match for Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And so this judgment upon Egypt and this destruction upon them is no doubt a reference to that. When he says, I will destroy the council of Egypt, and they'll seek to their idols and their charmers and their wizards and their mediums, and yet their counsel will be confounded. Of course, it means, as it says in Proverbs, through much counsel make war. Whenever a king was going to go to war, he'd have to consult his counselors. And the ancient Middle Eastern cultures, their counselors were magicians and astrologers. They weren't politicians, but more mystics and magicians who'd try to get some answer from the gods, or from the demons, as it really turns out. And he's saying essentially their counsel is not going to do them any good. They can get as much counsel from their spirits as they want to, but their spirits won't be able to save them or give them the strategy for victory. And they will instead be given over by God to the hand of a cruel lord, which would be Nebuchadnezzar, and a fierce king shall rule over them. So they were given over to Nebuchadnezzar, but notice how it says the Lord will give them over. It's not just the fortunes of battle seen from a secular perspective, that you know Nebuchadnezzar just happened to be stronger and he lusted for power and decided to go conquer Egypt and he managed to succeed because Egypt was weaker. There's far more involved in that. You know, the prophets were constantly showing the sovereignty of God in everything that developed on the earth, including the fall of great kingdoms. It never happened, as far as the prophets were concerned, that just a kingdom collapsed or that a kingdom just happened to win or lose a battle. It was always the Lord was delivering them into the hands of their enemies, or the Lord gave them the victory. And we've seen that already in Isaiah. It's also just a sort of a general way in which the prophets always speak, and all the prophets. They see God's hand beside everything, or behind everything that goes on, significantly shaping the history of the world. And that's seen also in the first verse of this chapter, where it says, the burden of Egypt, behold, the Lord rides upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, meaning they will be terrified. The heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. Well, this is actually a reference to the judgment that came on them through the Babylonian invasion, but it doesn't speak of Babylon by name. It speaks of the Lord coming against them. Again, the armies of Babylon are seen as the instrument that God uses, God's instrument of judgment. It's as though God was riding against Egypt, coming on a swift cloud. And by the way, this language agrees with some other passages where the clouds are said to be the chariot that God rides upon. In Psalm 104, for example, Psalm 104, verse 3 says, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who makes the clouds his chariot, who walks upon the wings of the wind. It says God makes the clouds his chariot. Well, a chariot was not just it wasn't like a car in our modern society. A chariot was more like a tank. A chariot was not just a means of transportation. It was a weapon of war. Some trust in horses and some in chariots means some trust in military armaments. Because horses and chariots were not ordinarily used by the citizens for getting around. They were distinctly armored cars of the time. You know, they were the instruments of war. So to say that God rides on the clouds as his chariot, it means that when he goes to war, the clouds are at his disposal. He rides on the clouds. And that's what it says in Isaiah 19:1. The Lord rideth upon the swift cloud and comes into Egypt. It's like the Lord is leading his angelic armies, but really what's going on is there's an earthly battle going on. And Nebuchadnezzar's armies are doing the stuff, but Isaiah sees above that and beyond that, God and his armies coming against Egypt to bring judgment. There's also in the book of Nahum, one of the minor prophets, after the book of Micah, Nahum chapter 1 and verse 3 makes this statement. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power and will not at all requite the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. Again, the clouds are seen as having some relevance to God's moving into a situation. The dust of his feet, of course, speaks of him running on foot. The image is slightly changed. This time it's not a picture of him in a chariot, but the point is still he's riding upon the clouds. The clouds basically are his, you know, he's transcendent, of course. The clouds represent that which is above man, above the earth, something that transcends man. Who could fight against an army that was actually on the clouds in a day when bows and arrows were the only weapons you had? You couldn't even shoot that high. So the idea here is that God is transcendent, and the clouds are the dust of his feet, or the clouds are his chariot. By the way, we won't get into this right now. We will when we talk about Matthew 24, but I suppose I ought to mention that in Matthew 24, Jesus said Matthew 24 and verse 30, they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, which is very frequently, if not most of the time, considered to be a prophecy about the second coming. And I do believe the Bible teaches very plainly that Jesus is coming again. I do believe in the second coming. But that particular passage, when we study it in Matthew 24 in its context, may not be properly understood as a picture of the second coming. To say that they'll see Jesus coming in the clouds might not be much different than the statement of Isaiah that says the Lord rides upon a cloud and comes into Egypt. Well, they didn't literally see God riding on a cloud or Jesus riding on a cloud when the Babylonians came in. The Lord riding on a cloud and coming into a situation speaks of what the prophet sees in the spirit as an earthly battle is taking place and a judgment from God, a military judgment is coming on a people. And there are some, at least, who believe that in Matthew 24, when Jesus talks about that, that it's a reference to the Roman armies coming in and destroying Jerusalem. And when it says they'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, that probably sounds like a little bit kind of a strange interpretation to most of us because it's a classic passage that is usually used of the second coming. But I might just compare that statement with another statement in Matthew that Jesus made a little later. And this would be in Matthew chapter 27. When Jesus was being interrogated by the Sanhedrin just before his crucifixion, he had been arrested now and he was being brought to the Sanhedrin for judgment. It said in Matthew 26, beginning with verse 62, and the high priest arose and said to him, "Answerest thou nothing? What is this that these witnesses witness against thee?" But Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, "I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said unto him, "Thou hast said. Nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Now the interesting thing here is that he was speaking to a body of men who died, I don't know when the last of them died, but probably within 40 or 50 years from that time they were all dead. And yet he said to them that they would see him coming with the clouds. And which is the same language he used in Matthew 24, which is the same language Isaiah used of the judgment came on Egypt by the Babylonian armies. I certainly wouldn't be dogmatic about this, but it does seem possible that this reference to him coming on the clouds is not one of the references to his second coming, though we have clear teaching in the scripture that Jesus is returning. Not every passage that we've always associated with that is necessarily talking about that. And we could say that 40 years later in 70 AD, when the Roman armies came in and wiped out Jerusalem, that some of these men on the Sanhedrin really were still alive. They did see this destruction come. And just as much as Egypt could see God coming on the clouds in the person of the armies of Babylon, so the Sanhedrin, in a sense, could be said to be seeing Jesus riding his chariots, as it were, the clouds, into Jerusalem when the armies of Rome wiped it out. Now, the language is not what we're accustomed to, And as I've said many times, we cannot require the prophets to speak in language such as our modern Western writers would use. The real issue for us is to decide not how they should have written, but how did they write? How did they intend to be understood? Because this is how, the only way you can understand the message of the Scripture is by understanding the method of communicating that they used. And so there is a possibility that some of those passages in Jesus' statement where he speaks of his coming on the clouds might be a reference to what happened to Jerusalem in 70 AD. And there are some scholars, some reasonably good ones, who believe that that is the case. And that would indicate that when Jesus said to the Sanhedrin, "You will see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven," that he's saying, essentially what he's saying is, you may seem to have the victory over me now, but in your lifetime, you're going to see that I'm really the victor. You're going to see me coming on my war chariots in the person of the Roman army. And if that doesn't sound like gentle Jesus, meek and mild, making a threat like that, the truth of the matter is, it wasn't a... Well, in any case, it was a threat. Whether it's a threat of his second coming, ultimately, or whether it's a threat of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, in either case, it's a threat. You know, he's essentially saying, I'm at your mercy now, it would appear, but someday you'll definitely be at my mercy. And it's kind of a heavy thing. But the language of Isaiah 19:1 gives us cause to reflect on whether these passages of him coming with clouds are a literal reference to his second coming, or whether they are a figurative reference to him, as it were, coming in the person of armies of enemies who come to destroy, because that's what it is in chapter 19 of Isaiah, when he says, "The Lord rides upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt." He certainly isn't talking about the second coming of Jesus. He's talking about the Babylonian armies, and that God is riding his chariots into Egypt, making war against Egypt, in other words. Well, that gives you something to chew on. You always get something. You'll get something to chew on out of everything in Isaiah. Well, let's go on. Let's go on down to verse 11 now. "Surely the princes of Zoan," which was an Egyptian city, "the princes of Zoan are fools. The council of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish," which means stupid. "How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of the ancient kings?" Now, what Isaiah is doing is he's addressing this prophecy right to the counselors of Egypt, the astrologers and the wise men of Egypt. "How dare you call yourselves the sons of the wise, the son of the ancients? Where are they? Where are thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts hath purposed upon Egypt." In other words, I, the prophet of the Lord, can tell you what God has purposed on Egypt, but your wise men don't have any idea. They're stupid, he says. They've become brutish. They're fools because they don't see the writing on the wall. They don't see that Egypt is rebelling against God and God is going to come and judge them. Let your wise men, you know, they claim to be wise, but they can't tell you what the purpose of God is. And that's what, of course, every nation needs, is someone within its ranks that knows what the purpose of God is, what God has purposed upon the people of that place and that time. "The princes of Zoan have become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also seduced Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. The Lord hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof." And that almost sounds like some of those other passages that speak of God sending an evil spirit as an act of judgment upon a nation or a king. It says, "God has mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt which the head or tail, branch or rut